Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. You're here with Tim, Charlie, Andy, and Josh. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast. I got you.
Let's move that one up to two times speed.
Chesed. So how are we doing?
Chesed and shalom. God bless you.
Grace and mercy.
Close.
Grace and peace.
Grace and mercy. Mercy and peace.
It's good to see you guys. That's all I'm going to say. Although the bubbler today that we're drinking is wild cherry, and it is very good.
I do think this is my favorite flavor of bubbler.
Really?
Up to this point.
I think there's a tart cherry one. I could be wrong, and I did not like it. And so when I saw wild cherry, I'm like, is that different? But this is definitely nicer. I like it much better. So, Josh, what are your thoughts?
You're welcome.
Josh made the decision. We were downstairs, and I was like, all right, do you want triple berry or cherry? And he's like, cherry. And I was like,
where did
you
made all...
the decision for everybody.
Where did these all come from again?
The fridge
downstairs. I've just been buying them and sticking them in the fridge.
Oh, my
It's
goodness.
A line item in the Thinklings budget.
Yeah.
Ah.
Extensive Thinklings budget.
Joke's on you. We don't have any lines. So
I know. I know there's no lines.
So that made me think
Thank
of something.
You,
I'm paying
Tim.
For it.
Thank you, Tim.
That made me think of something that happened in class today. This has nothing to do with our podcast. But so the drama is happening this weekend, which they are actually doing something pretty meritorious. It's Shakespeare. And I asked my students, how many of you are in the drama? And two of them raised their hands. And I said, okay, be honest with me. Is it worth my time? And this is in class. So all the class is now like...
Is this going to need to be redacted?
Everything needs to be redacted. And they're both like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was like, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm still not going to go. But that's good for me to hear. And the class thought that was really funny.
That's fantastic, Charlie.
But, Much Ado About Nothing, Shakespeare, tomorrow night. If you want to go see it. Well, this is posting after it's happened, so. Maybe some of our listeners experienced that, and it was good. Maybe I will go. All right, are we
Hey, there's isn't there a translation module coming up in the seminary?
Translation?
Bible translation?
Oh, yeah, there is a Bible translation. Yeah.
So I have still forgotten to tell my Greek students about that, but it sounds kind of interesting. Yeah. So
I've got a module in May, rapid Hebrew reading. So if you've had Hebrew
that.
With me, we're going to translate through Deuteronomy. It's going to be a new type of a thing. So
that looked interesting, Tim. Yeah.
I'm not sure if we'll get through the whole book. I mean, to translate all of Deuteronomy in 1 week would be insane, but we should be able to get through a lot of it. And I've got some new ideas. We'll see how it goes.
That seems pretty.
I have no idea.
Oh, I'm
rapid.
Oh, oh, wow.
I thought that was an easy one.
Yeah, that was a little too easy, I think.
Sorry. You should have wrapped that up in sorry.
All right. Books and business.
Oh, my goodness. Let's talk about some books.
There we go. This week, I'm just going to mention the book that did play a part in my prep for the sermon, which is going to become the content today. And it's Godly Jealousy, A Theology of Intolerant Love by Eric Tonnis. And it was a good book. I enjoyed it. It was helpful. If you find what we talk about today on the podcast interesting, I would recommend the book. It is only available as a paper book or on Logos's platform. There's no Kindle edition. And so it forced me to use a Logos book. But what I found is that Logos does phenomenal with the page numbers. So like, I did not know this. I'm probably going to start buying a lot of it. You just can't scribble on the page like I can with my Kindle or use an e-reader. But it was really nice. And then also tracking through it at my desk using the browser and like the headings, that was really nice. So I did not realize how helpful that is. So just if any of you have Logos, it's a pretty great resource. But Tonnis is going to walk through the issue of jealousy, why it's a big deal, and he'll explain it very textually. So he does a lot of study, a lot of research in the Greek and the Hebrew. And I thought he does a really good job. And there's a little bit of a pastoral heart to it, too. So I would recommend it. Do I rank it? I didn't finish reading it. I know I read at least 100 pages, so I'll give you a $1 book review, a penny per page. I would say it's like a 7 or an 8, definitely. That's my $1 book review.
Book I've been working through is Pastoring Men, What Works, What Doesn't, and Why Men's Discipleship Matters Now More Than Ever. And the author, Patrick Morley, he has published a whole bunch of stuff about men's ministry. I think probably his like biggest one that has been reprinted multiple times is The Man in the Mirror, Solving 24 Problems Men Face. But The Christian Man, I'm scrolling through Amazon, Devotions for the Man in the Mirror. You know, there's just a whole bunch of, you know, No Man Left Behind, a lot of men's titles from this one guy. And I don't really know if I've gotten through enough of it to really gauge what I'm looking at yet. I haven't really studied that guy at all. So like to understand where he is in his theology or what his churches are like. But I mean, it seems pretty standard type of ideas and fare as you kind of flip through. Probably the idea I liked in the Pastoring Men, in fact, this was really intriguing how he started the book, is it was a letter from a pastor to the layman. And it was kind of like very like kind of in your face a little bit of like imagining the scenario of like a guy in church going to the pastor and is like, why don't we do anything for men's ministry? You should do this. And this is like the pastor replying in this letter. And it's like, yeah, I agree. I've tried this. And, you know, I'd really love for that to happen. And so I thought this is a really kind of way to capture kind of the idea. And I don't remember where it was, but he made this comment about that needs to be something for every man in the church. Like the normal guy, like so you have to have a men's ministry for every normal guy. It's not just the ones that really like this one thing or one certain age or one certain skill, but you need to approach it like every normal guy. And I like that idea. Like it has to be something that every normal guy, like just the you know, simple guy can be a part of. And so I don't know exactly what that means. If we try too hard with the things that we do, we're not trying hard enough. I don't know, but I like some of the things he said. So you probably hear more about some of his works over the next months or so.
What was the title again?
This one was Pastoring Men, What Works, What Doesn't, and Why It's Important. And then there's a whole bunch of other titles.
Yeah, I know he's written some other ones. Yeah, but that one I don't think I'm familiar with. Pastoring Men.
I resonate with that thought you brought up, that it has to be something for all the men, not just one type. Mm-hmm. I started going to one church, and I love this church, and I was there a long time. We all know which one I'm talking about. And I had two Nissan Sentras, and I didn't own a single gun. And every week, I felt like I lost my man card, because everybody hunted and all that. And so then, early on, the group would go like...
I didn't hunt.
Muddin'.
I didn't go muddin'.
What's that?
I didn't go muddin'.
No, I know, that's the thing, is like, but it was interesting, because then... Oh yeah, like that was good for me to be like, I'm the outsider. Like, oh, and so I like that. I do like that. Like, what is something that would encompass everybody? Everyone would feel like they go to. I like that.
From a marketing perspective, men's books don't get read.
Mention it? Oh,
they don't get read. They don't get bought.
Do you know? Okay, look, this is an interesting.
This is something
study.
That I'm thinking through because I'm thinking about writing a men's book. Why is it that men don't read men's books? Because
okay,
don't read, period.
Okay, well, that you answered the question that I was like, why do you said they don't get sold? And I asked why, and you're like, why don't men read men's books? And like, you actually answered it right there. Yeah. Men don't read.
Men don't read, right. That's but still, it doesn't matter. How many men's books have you read before this one?
Well, am I a representative cross section of the normal man?
Uh huh.
I mean, probably dozens.
You have?
I mean,
well, before I started studying masculinity, I hadn't read hardly any.
Oh, I probably read 3 or 4.
Really?
Yeah, like stuff assigned for class, or like I was a discipling guy, and Dr. Doug actually recommended one, the Disciplines for a Godly Man. I can't remember.
Yeah, Disciplines of a Godly Man by Kent Hughes.
Have you read that?
Yeah, like forever ago or whatever. But
that's a men's book.
I know, but it was like 20 years ago.
Well, still,
I haven't read a men's book in like forever.
I think we would be really surprised going through the discipline. If we like had like realistic data of how much guys in church read, like Christian men, like how much they read, period. And then to actually be reading something targeted to them about spiritual leadership formation, that would even be a much smaller subsection of the ones actually reading. But I think that's probably the systemic problem, is the men just aren't reading.
So from my personal observation, this is totally anecdotal. If men are reading, what they read is generally not how to be a man from a man's book.
It's generally Lord of the Rings.
Or if they're theologically...
also known as How to Be a Man.
Or if they're theologically minded, they're reading like commentaries, or they're getting into deeper resources. Yeah. Okay, so...
Chilton's manuals, yes.
Very nice.
Yikes.
Half our readers aren't going to know what a Chilton's manual is.
Tim, this is normally...
We have YouTube now.
This is normally the point in the podcast where you roll your eyes and get the rest of us to stop being a distraction so we can move on. Would you...
Okay, stop being horrendous.
Okay, thank
Let's
you.
Do this. So my book is Chesed and the New Testament, an intertextual categorization study by Karen Nelson. So Chesed is a common, it's a really important word in the Old Testament. I've thought about having some of my students write some papers on key Old Testament words and ideas. Chesed would be included. Chesed is often translated steadfast love, or mercy, or kindness. It has a lot of different meanings. There's another book, Gordon Clark is the author, and the title of the book is The Word Chesed in the Hebrew Bible. So I've been studying Chesed in preparation for a sermon, and the one I'm going to talk about today, at least, is Chesed in the New Testament. It's interesting because Chesed is a Hebrew word. It's in the Old Testament. So is there a correlation to the New Testament? And the author is arguing that there is. The author also thought that the correlation would be love or grace, and it isn't. The correlation in the New Testament is eleos, mercy. Yes, so most of the translations in the Old Testament translated as like steadfast love. So should it be more along the lines of like mercy? Or is that steadfast love a good idea? So it's an interesting book. I've enjoyed it. It's not as it's not as deep as I was wanting it to be. I was hoping for a little bit more. The research isn't really too extensive, even for an academic book, but it was still interesting and helpful. I'm going to read on page one. This monograph deals with the relationship between Chesed and the New Testament, a relationship that is not obvious in English translations of the Bible. I focus particularly on eleos and hasios, those are two Greek words, commonly rendered mercy and holy. The most frequent LXX translations of the noun Chesed and the related adjective Chesed, respectively, as keys to reveal that relationship. So, interesting book, chapter 7. She works through Matthew's gospel and then Paul and then other New Testament uses. Matthew's gospel is particularly interesting because Matthew quotes Hosea 6:6 directly. And in that quotation, it's actually challenging my previous understanding of Matthew 9:13 and 12:7. So you might be like, what in the world's up with Matthew 9:13? Well, Jesus is basically telling the Pharisees and the Sadducees, stop it. You're being bad. So Matthew 9:11, and when the Pharisees saw it, they said to his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? When Jesus heard that, he said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. But go and learn what this means. Isn't that fascinating? Was Jesus telling them? He's not giving them an answer. He's saying, go and learn what this means. And then he quotes Hosea 6:6, I desire mercy, that's chesed, and not sacrifice. For I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. And so it's actually challenging my understanding of that passage, and it's been really good. So I've appreciated the study, and my book's in business, Chesed and the New Testament.
So the first time I heard about Chesed was I had a colleague at my former university that wrote a book called The Fifth Love.
Chesed.
It was Chesed, the fifth love.
Oh.
And he was kind of critiquing Lewis's four loves.
So that's another, oh, that's interesting.
But Lewis, of course, is dealing with the Greek concepts of love, but that's interesting that you're looking at the Greek.
Yeah, movies. I'm not familiar, so that's an actual book, huh?
It is, love. But I think it was maybe a self-published book that he wrote on a sabbatical. I have it in my office if you want to look at it. But the book I have today is the novel The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene. a preeminent 20th century British and Catholic author. And of note, Graham Greene was also recruited by MI6 to be a spy for the British government in Sierra Leone during World War II.
No way.
Yeah. So kind of interesting guy. It's set in the late 1920s in Mexico when there was pretty profound persecution. And so there was, in the novel, they're called the Red Shirts, and they're going around and trying to find priests and get rid of them, either execute them or have them apostatize and marry and just resume normal life. And so you have two priests within this novel, but the protagonist is known as the Whiskey Priest. You never know his real name, but it's about his efforts to try to evade the lieutenant who is trying to track him down and execute him. And it's just an interesting novel. The priest is, he has some besetting sins. One of them, of course, is his attraction and imbibing of whiskey regularly. And that, of course, or not of course, that in the past caused him to beget a child with a woman as well. And so there's that dynamic. And the whole time he's kind of wandering around and wondering if he's worth anything as a priest and all of these things. But it's an interesting novel. There's maybe one or two scenes that deal with some things. It's cloaked language. It's vague references, but you'd want to be aware of that. That's not atypical of Greene. I haven't read I've read a few of his novels, but not all of them. He's a pretty prolific author. But I just wanted to read the first paragraph so you can see, or not see, excuse me, you can hear his style. It's chapter one, The Port. Mr. Tench went out to look for his ether cylinder into the blazing Mexican sun and the bleaching dust. A few vultures looked down from the roof with shabby indifference. He wasn't carrion yet. A faint feeling of rebellion stirred in Mr. Tench's heart, and he wrenched up a piece of the road with splintering fingernails and tossed it feebly towards them. One rose and flapped across the town, over the tiny plaza, over the bust of an ex-president, ex-general, ex-human being, over the two stalls which sold mineral water, towards the river and the sea. It wouldn't find anything there. The sharks looked after the carrion on that side. Mr. Tench went on across the plaza. So just beautiful writing, really takes you to the scene, appeals to our senses. You know, there's some of the things that we talk about with excellent writing, but that's The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene.
All right, let's have a conversation about jealousy. Specifically, is God a jealous God? And so that question is like not a hard question, because if you read in the Bible, there's all kinds of places, especially in the Old Testament, that say that God is jealous. Now, I don't know if you guys have had the same experience I have growing up, but when I think of jealousy, and I think of what it means, I don't come out of my, like, I don't come up with an answer that is a complimentary answer. So is anyone, when you think, let's just do this to start off, what is jealousy in your guys' opinion? Give me biblical, give me cultural, like whatever idea you have in your mind.
Jealous. I'm a little tainted by the Old Testament, so...
I figured, but that's fine. Go ahead and share that, because that's going to be some of our
That's a t-shirt. I'm tainted by the Old Testament.
Thinklings Podcast.
Tim Little.
Ooh, that's good.
Ooh, I like that. That could be fun.
Tim's in. He's like, I'm there.
So when I think of jealousy, I think of fervor. And I think of like somebody who is emotionally like... active.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. You got it.
Could start there maybe.
Okay. Anyone else? Or is that the only understandings of jealousy?
Well, in Othello by Shakespeare, it's famously called the green-eyed monster.
Ooh.
And culturally, we tend to conflate jealousy and envy.
Yes.
But when it's called the green-eyed monster in Othello, it's actually what I would say is appropriate description of jealousy, because Othello is being told lies by Iago about his wife Desdemona, and he's jealous in the sense that her affection rightly belongs to him. And so when anyone threatens that, he's right to be jealous because it's affection that is due to him as her husband.
So. Okay.
That's like very Old Testament-ish.
Indeed.
Okay, conflating so it with envy.
Can I be New Testament-ish?
Go sure. for it.
So I think it is very hard to split the terms, and I obviously do believe that words mean things objectively. They have ranges of meaning when they're being used. But modern parlance of covetousness,
yep.
envy,
yes.
greed,
yep.
jealous,
yep.
all of those get so used synonymously, it's hard mm-hmm. to pull them away. So what I think of when you mention jealous, not only does it mention that God is jealous in James 4, but the idea of I have something I want and I don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a myriad of reactions that could happen in the heart at that point. And so what's the difference of I wanted something, I didn't get it. My reaction is jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted something, I didn't get it. My reaction was envy, or the root was envy yep. versus jealous versus covet. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it's just super hard to parse that out. But what I think of is, a reaction to unmet desire is what my mind went to.
That so this is super helpful, because growing up, Charlie, I think I only had the salad or the meal you just prepared. I would just say take a pepper shaker full of suspicion and just put a little suspicion and fear in there. Mm. And that's what I thought jealousy was. So then when I would read anywhere in the Bible where it said God is jealous, I would think of this wimpy husband who's scared his beautiful wife is having a dalliance and so he's going to lock her away, and he's going to be suspicious, and he's going to spy on her, and he's going to be a little mad all the time because he's just thinking she's going to cheat on him, and kind of a like petulant, petty, suspicious, fear-driven envy with maybe some bitter malice in there too. So I thought that was when I was assigned this by my pastor to preach on this, I was like, I don't really know that I want to do this, because I didn't have any of the Old Testament or classic literature in my veins. I didn't have any of that.
And I should just say that when Shakespeare is using that, it is a destructive force as it's presented in the play. I'm not saying that he has the same,
sure.
but I think Shakespeare is playing with this idea mm-hmm. of the distinction between jealousy and envy.
But what you said, that we tend to conflate those two things, I really appreciate that you said that, because I think that's how I grew up. I thought envy and jealousy were like synonyms. So, oh, go ahead.
So here, literature men across the table. So you're talking about Shakespeare. Would you think that jealous, scale of 1 to 10, how appropriate would the term jealous be to apply to Gollum in the Ring, in Lord of the Rings? Gollum in the Ring? In the Ring.
Technically, the ring left him. And it's not
like it wasn't his, but he wants it. Like, is there some jealousy there? Would envy be the right word? Covet?
The way that I understand it is that
lust.
It'd be envy or covetousness or something. When I think of jealousy, is you have the thing, and somebody's threatening it. Whereas envy, I don't have the thing, but I want it.
So
somebody else has yep. it, and I want it.
So, and here's the point. So Gollum is envious. Would we then say Sam is jealous for Frodo? Ooh. Like he's trying to protect the thing, his relationship with this that's being taken, swayed.
There's a possibility there. We'll have to wait to see what we decide on, what the meaning of it is.
Yeah, okay.
But I think that I hold on to that.
So like maybe that we could fit the trio of those words into that there. Anyway.
All right. So in my study, I started off by just starting and looking at what does culture think. Okay. So what's a culture today think? So where do you go to find out what a word means? dictionary.com, of course. And so I looked it up. And now I know. Some, there's more hoity-toity ways to do this. But I'm like, what's a common man going to do? What are they going to do? They're going to look it up on the web and probably dictionary.com or something like that. And so it gave a definition, and then it did something even better. It had, here's a word usage description. And so I want to read the word usage description that dictionary.com gives. What does jealousy mean? Jealousy is a feeling or state of resentment, bitterness, or hostility toward someone because they have something that you don't. Jealousy usually occurs as a result of someone owning something you want but can't have, or achieving some kind of success that you want to achieve but have not been able to. This sense of jealousy is very similar in meaning to envy, which refers mostly to negative feeling of desire for something that someone else has that you don't, like a mix of admiration and discontent. However, while envy is not necessarily malicious, jealousy usually implies deeper resentment, perhaps because you feel that you deserve the thing more than the other person, or that it is unfair that they have it and you don't. Now, that is saying it's a dictionary. It's saying this is what the word means, but remember, everybody, a dictionary is a descriptor. It's not a lawmaker. It doesn't tell you how you have to use it. You should use it that way because that's the common way it's using, but it's saying we're describing the current state of the definition. And I'm going to land later saying I think their definition is a little off, especially if you're thinking of the Bible. And that would go on basically with what you just said, Josh. And that definition there basically described envy. However, there is like a thread or a vein of that that does make sense. But also look at all of those descriptors: resentment, bitterness, envy, negative feelings, discontentment, maliciousness, and deeper resentment. That, am I to apply that to God and his character? That's what's always been hard with me when it comes to jealousy in the Bible. Now, the next example I want to give you is a quote from Richard Dawkins. Now, I did not know the history of the title of this article. I just knew what it was, and I knew this is what it was called, and Josh, you've just illumined me. So Richard Dawkins is an atheist. He is a biological evolutionist. He says there's no such thing as religion or God or anything. Well, there is religion, but there's no truth to it. And so everything about you right now can be explained genetically through your biology. So when you get angry, it's fight or flight. When you get scared, it's fight or flight. When you're happy or sad, it's fight or, like, whatever. It's natural selection. It's all that. And so he wrote an article called Banishing the Green-Eyed Monster. And so he's literally playing off that title. And in it, he says this. He makes the argument that jealousy is a byproduct of biological evolution, and that at one point in the past, it helped prior forms of the human species to survive. So here's the quote. From a Darwinian perspective, sexual jealousy is easily understood. Natural selection of our wild ancestors plausibly favored males who guarded their mates for fear of squandering economic resources on other men's children. And so he's saying a male gorilla wouldn't want another male gorilla canoodling with his female gorilla, because then if she has babies, they're not his, and he'd have to take care of those babies. And I'm just like, who has a pet, and whose pet has developed thoughts like that? Like this is a bunch of nonsense. Now, it may have...
It does happen with some species of animals.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
okay.
But here's my supposition. Can you prove that in their brain, they're having those thoughts?
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
No, you can't prove that. That's anthropomorphizing it. However, I think what he's saying is the ones who exhibited that behavior, it privileged them. They survived better because they had less resources to gather. And so then that ingrained guarding of our spouse is actually just a biological leftover of evolution. Yeah. So you're correct. There are, I mean, this happens all the time in the wild. He's saying this is why. Anytime there's a why and it doesn't take into account the Bible, you're going to have problems. Now, in this article, he then argues that since it comes from evolution, why do we care about it today? So he says this. We basically need to discard sexual jealousy. He says, I am not denying the power of sexual jealousy. It is ubiquitous if it's not universal. I am just wondering aloud why we all accept it so readily without ever thinking about it. And why don't we all admire, as I increasingly do, those rare free spirits who are confident enough to rise above jealousy, stop fretting about who's cheating on whom, and tell the green-eyed monster to go jump in a lake. Now, what is he? Connect the dots for the listeners. He's saying, let's get rid of sexual jealousy because it's just a leftover of evolution. And then what is that doing to marriage?
It's like nothing. It doesn't mean anything anymore.
Open season.
Right, right.
Open marriage. Go for it. So he's actually arguing against traditional marriage. He's arguing against any sort of a God-honoring marriage. And he wrote this when he was in his third marriage because he'd already divorced two other ladies. And so he eventually did divorce his third one. Okay. So there's another example here, and I'm just going to briefly mention it. I saw an interview once of a friend who was talking about her other friend who got divorced. And this lady got bored in her marriage. She saw all her girlfriends having boyfriends, and her husband just worked all the time, provided for her, and she was at home all day with the kids, and she thought, I could do way better. So she divorces his little self. And then 3 years later, she can't find anyone to marry her or even date her, because as soon as they find out that she has kids, they're like, well, I'm not doing that. Well, the guy met another lady who had kids, and after a year, and then they'd been together ever since. And so this first lady said, I can't believe you moved on so quickly. And whenever I think about them, I am just so jealous. So again, that envy idea. So what then is the dilemma that I'm going to raise? Well, part of what we've seen in this description is there's a lot of anger, and I don't think we could say it's all righteous anger. Part of it is there's a lot of fear driving them. So in all these scenarios, there's like an element of fear. Are we feeling confident in saying God is fearful? That's why he's jealous. He gets angry. Now, understanding God being angry doesn't bother me as much as God's afraid and he's got to, you know, like he's too scared. He wants friends or something. There's a general element of malice going on and general pettiness. So I had a hard time with that. So what is jealousy? So here's the study. Now, the book that I recommended or I referenced earlier, Godly Jealousy by Eric Tonnes, what he does is he looks at the word jealousy in the Bible and he goes through all 90 occurrences and he uses the Greek word and the Hebrew word to do this. So the Greek word is zelos or zealous, and zealous is just like jealous with a Z instead of a J, and it means something very similar. And then the Hebrew word is kana, and it also means jealousy. And so he does a word study, and I'm just going to give you some of the information. So as far as the Hebrew term goes, one dictionary says you could translate it as ardor. Ardor is like enthusiasm or passion. It's like an intense response. You could translate it zeal, great energy or enthusiasm in pursuit of something, or just the word jealousy. And then other scholars say this, it's an intense, energetic state of mind toward action, which is caused by an infringement of someone's rights or an injury of the subject's honor. Now it sounds a little bit more like the Othello idea you were bringing up earlier, Josh. Another resource said you could actually translate the word as furious. And then lastly, another guy said this, it's a really strong emotion whereby some quality or possession of the object is desired by the subject. And so then he gives a whole bunch of texts. I'm just going to read a few. Exodus 25. You shall not worship them, being idols or other gods, or serve them, for I, the Lord, am your God, am a jealous God. Exodus 34:14. For you shall not worship any other God, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. Deuteronomy 4:24. For the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. And Ezekiel 16:38 and 42. Thus I will judge you, like women who commit adultery or shed blood are judged. And I will bring on you the blood of wrath and of jealousy. So I will calm my fury against you, and my jealousy will depart from you, and I will be pacified and angry no more. Now this is interesting. If you described all of those things but didn't tell me the word was jealousy, and you're like, what word do you think is being described? Probably like intense emotional response is how I would describe it. And I would have no problem thinking God has intense emotional responses or elevated responses. No problem at all. But the jealousy part, because it's so tinged with like a sinful, bitter envy, it kind of gets weird. All right, Greek term, It is an intense positive interest in something. So I would say like me and coffee. Or it could also be an intense negative feeling over another's achievements or success. So if I was thinking like Maranatha Baptist University beating us or something like that. Other scholarship says you would translate it in any of the following ways. This is Liddell and Scott for those of you who know. Jealousy, zeal, envy, fervor, indignation. That one sort of rings true in my mind. Like there's an indignancy that's okay. And then emulation. And another guy said this, it's an emotional going out to a person or an idea or a cause. There's like strong emotions. So now Tonis, the guy who's doing the study here, came up with a couple of conclusionary statements that I thought were really helpful. He said, as the aforementioned lexical studies indicate, and as my analysis of the 90 occurrences of the words in the Bible show, the word kana and the word zelos both represent exclusive single-mindedness of emotion, which may be morally blameworthy or praiseworthy, depending on both the object and the motive of jealousy. He goes on to say, jealousy is like a proper thing for God. It's akin to an infringement of a right where we seek to right that infringement. With God, that's perfectly proper. And he says this, because of the negative connotations, however, that jealousy carries, there seems to be an increasing tendency to opt for the more general and vague terms, such as like zeal. He also says this, and I think this is really perceptive. This is huge. He says, human understanding of jealousy is often primarily based on our experience of it in our own lives, which is often unwarranted or sinfully expressed and destructive. And I would say, I think that's my favorite perceptive element that he brought to the table. I think most of us, when we experience jealousy, we experience whatever it is, either envy or we actually experience it, but it's like a sinfully expressed version. Then when we go back and say God's jealous, we kind of have this quandary. So he gives a bunch of New Testament text, and I'm just going to skip those for now. So here, I was trying to understand this. So how do I understand this? So here's my three illustrations. So if I had a possession and it was stolen and you guys saw me learn about it and I got animated, I don't think you would initially think, whoa, you're animated, you're in sin. Okay. So my example is in gym class in high school, you had to change in your gym clothes. And then after gym, I came back and my wallet was hanging out of my back pocket, folded up in my clothes. And I was like, why is that out? And I opened it and I had $20 in there and it was gone. Now, back then, a dollar was what it cost for a gallon of gas. So it's like 20 gallons of gas. And I made $5.25 an hour at Fairway. So that was 4 hours of work. So I was like frustrated. Well, ended up finding the guy who had it, confronted him, and he just melted and gave it right back and felt bad. And it was just a weird scenario. I wasn't like angry. I didn't know what to do. I was scared. And it was like a friend of mine. It was like a weird thing. And he didn't actually admit to it. He's like, well, here, I got 20. I'll give you mine. And I'm like, this looks just like mine. It's folded the same way. It was a weird scenario.
Well, I didn't take it, but I have a $20 bill. Do you want it?
Yeah, I know. It's like, what just happened? Fancy that. So, but if, in that scenario, if I had like been angry, I could definitely be sinfully angry, but I don't think anyone would be like, oh, he got angry because someone stole his property. We'd all be like, yeah, it's his property. We got to go get that back for him. Right. And so I think there, the anger, it's like $20. So it's hard to get like that wound up about it. All right. Let's change the illustration and make it a little bit more difficult. What about a stolen child? Like, I'm telling you, if you heard about a potential kid, like you hear about these potential kidnappings where someone's walking in or out of a mall or something or a store, and a guy goes to grab something and a really good natured Samaritan bystander jumps and tackles the guy and everything is foiled. But like when you see a news story like that, you don't like, oh, that happened. Like there's something inside of you that's like, that is horrible. And if it was your kid, I would all my see that heightened of energy in its like that intense response that really resonates. Oh, okay. So if I saw that happening, the intense response would be huge. You see someone kicking a pregnant lady. an intense response is perfectly appropriate. No one's like, whoa, you got a little out of control there. Can we calm down for just a minute and let's be in control? Let's go talk to the guy and reason with him. Now, granted, there is a part of our culture that would say that. And so there we fully understand that a fast, strong, intense, energetic response is appropriate. So what would we call that? Well, I would say it's an energetic response. Well, there's an aspect here. If it's my kid, that's actually, I think, what the Bible means by jealousy. That helped me to understand this. Now, the last one, it makes sense, but we all will have a little bit of an issue here. Don't think of stolen money. Don't think of a stolen child. Think of a stolen spouse. Now, here, there's a little bit of a tricky part to it, because a spouse is not a kid, and a spouse is not a $20 bill. A spouse is another human being with agency and choice-making ability. And so if they leave me to go be with someone else, what do you do? Like, part of me is like I've always seen in those, you know, like you see a TV show or something in, or a movie, and the lady goes with the other guy. And then the first guy's like, I'm going to kill that guy. And is he think he's going to kill him and get the lady back or something? Like, I don't understand this. I've never thought, like, why are you going to go beat the guy up other than just to vent your rage? And it's like, he's thinking he's going to get her back. But I think most of the time it's not that. He's just venting his rage. Yeah, he's just angry. So now, why is this coming up at our church? It's because Pastor Danny's preaching through Hosea. And so you have Hosea and Gomer, and Gomer is playing the whore. And then God is saying to Hosea, go get her back. Because that's like me and my people. They're playing the whore, and yet I'm going to restore them. So here's where the whole thing got really interesting to me. So I think my typical response, if something like that were to happen, maybe let's put it in a friendship like you have a friend and then your friend stabs you in the back and goes and hangs out with another group or something like that. Whatever you want to think. I think at that point, I'm like, whatever. You don't want, okay, fine. I'm moving on. And you're just going to move on. You're a little bit bitter. You're not going to talk to that person. But here, what if that's how God treated his people, whom he made a covenant with, whom he promised to love unconditionally? Well, God would actually be being the wicked person. So this is where it opened my eyes that biblical jealousy has a very strong connection to biblical love. So when God loves his people and he's unwilling to let them do what is bad because he loves them so much and he pursues them, that's actually biblical jealousy. Now in Hosea, he doesn't go and, you know, kill them all or go and drag them back and hang them. And like, you think of the jealous husband who like locks the wife in the house and he monitors her movements and he's like, that's terrible. What does God do in Hosea? He's very gentle. He takes her back when things go bad. And so to me, this was really, really helpful. So there's three stories that I'll reference because of the lateness of the hour, we won't go through them, but maybe we'll just talk about it. So there, Eric Tonis gives a number of examples of people in the Bible who exhibit godly jealousy. He talks about a number of them, but I picked three to go through. So Phineas, David, and Jesus. So Phineas in Numbers 25. Tim, do you know that one off the top of your head as an OT guy?
I mean, I don't have it memorized, but it's...
Can you know, summarize the story?
Oh, the story? Yeah, sure. Yeah. So
summarize the story for our listeners. What happens in Numbers 25?
So there's the sin of Baal Peor, where the Israelites were beginning to worship Baal with the Moabites. So this one guy goes and marries a Midianite princess and then brings her back into the camp. And they're doing it very flagrantly. They're just kind of walking right through the front door. It's not like they're trying to be hiding or being propriety or anything. And then he just takes the girl right into his tent. And so everybody knows what they're doing in there. So Phineas just goes and grabs a spear and kills them both.
It's a 2-for-1 deal.
2-for-1.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the initial context starts off condemning the people for beginning to whore with the daughters of Moab. And so Moses and the leadership are gathered together to say, what are we going to do about this? And God through Moses says, each one of you heads of group, like families, you need to go and kill anyone among you who has committed this sin. And right then is when the guy walks by that group. I mean, it's like timing couldn't be worse. And so then I'm just thinking, imagine being in that group. You're one of the heads of the tribes or whatever. And Moses is like, okay, go find anyone married to a Midianite right now and kill them, because we're going to purge the evil from our midst. You know these people. Like, you live next door to these people. Like, what do you mean? Like, I can just imagine if I'm there, I'm like, okay, wait. So I just want to make sure. Moses is like, you mean like right now? Like, do I talk to him? Like, I would have so many questions. And Phineas is like, it's simple. God's holiness is offended. We got to do this. Oh, there's a guy. All right, off I go. And he's doing that not because he's war, you know, he likes war fighting and all that. He's doing it for the honor of the Lord. And so the text says that later, that he actually turned back God's jealousy and he gets this great honor in the chapter. And so here you see the intense, quick, loyal response to God was an exhibiting or demonstrating that Phineas loved God in that same kind of a jealous way that is like good. Now, David in 1 Samuel 17 is another example. I'm going to skip that one for now. And then Jesus in John 2. So in John 2, we'll skim read this one a little bit too. So you start at verse 13, and this is a pretty famous story. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons, and the money changers were sitting there. And so Jesus walks into the temple, and he sees that it's become a business place. And I'd heard, I don't know if this is true or not, but I'd heard that the temple actually made a rule that you couldn't bring your own animals, you had to buy their animals. I don't know if that's true or not, but if that is, that's even worse. But also, money changers are probably changing the money so you can buy the animals, and I'm guessing they're changing it at quite the profit. And then maybe the priests are even saying like, yeah, yours is not good enough. You better go buy one of those. Like, it just, it's become this horrible business situation. And so now Jesus, because he's very PC and he has a lot of nuance, calls an assembly and he says, hey guys, let's talk about this. Like, what do you guys think about this? Like, he's very, sorry, Josh is over here losing it. No, that's not what he does. It says he made a whip out of cords and he drove them all out of the temple. And he drove out the sheep and the oxen, and he poured out the coins and the money of the money changers, and he literally flips over tables. He told those who sold the pigeons, take these things away and do not make my father's house, a house of trade. So his disciples are watching this, and they're like, whoa, Jesus just cracked. He like just totally, something, the switch flipped. What happened? And then they remembered, and it says this. They remembered, his disciples remembered that it is written, zeal for your house will consume me. Now, the word zeal there is literally the word that would otherwise be translated jealousy. Now, there I understand zeal. It is an intense response to it. And that's actually quoting Psalm 69 written by David. So, as we concluded our study, this is some thoughts I had. Think about the implications of banishing the green-eyed monster. Now, envy, yes. Okay, envy can be discarded. But imagine if we did not want to have this kind of an intense biblical zeal for the things that God has said are right and proper and good. What would that do to our marriages? It would take Richard Dawkins's ethos of marriage and spread it through the culture, and it would just wreck families all over the place. And again, I think there can be a zeal that is based on an intense response that's not out of God's love. So be careful. You could have what you think is zeal or jealousy, but because it's your flesh that was provoked or your sinful motivation, the Bible would call that an outburst of wrath. And that is not what we mean here. But it is right for us to have good, intense responses to evil things. That is actually very biblical. So why is it good that God is a jealous God? Here's the question I want us to consider. So we really are prone to bitterness and revenge and wrath when people wrong us or sin against us. So I can imagine a wife saying, you know, the husband does something for the last time, and she's like, you know what? He's dead to me. she just walks away from the marriage. Or I can even think of a husband who's like, I am so over her. I am done caring about her. And yeah, he's going to be married, but he's just going to be a distant husband. He's not going to put himself out there. He's just not going to care about her. It's really good that when God loves us, he doesn't love us the way we would love. He's dead to me, we might say, but that guy's not dead to God. I don't care about her. I'm done caring about her. But God is not done caring about her. God is not like us. Okay, so his love is not in danger of going away when sins begin to pile up. In fact, a mountain of sin, a whole entire mountain, cannot remove God's love, because God's love is not based on our behavior or our earning it. His love is based on him and him alone. Now think about how good this is for us. God says he loves you. God says that he will forgive you. And he says that he never will leave you or forsake you if you're a believer. If one of you guys at the table said that to me, I would be like, I believe you, but also you're a human and maybe there would be a limit. But I mean, I know you guys. I think you really would. If someone off the street said that to me, I don't think I would take it seriously at all. If my spouse said it, yes, very seriously. But I know in all of these scenarios, we're human. We're not perfect. We might just walk away. But when God says, I love you, I care about you, I will forgive you, I'm never going to leave you, he won't, even if we try to leave him. And that is why jealousy is such a good thing in the Bible. Now, consider how this would apply. Well, first of all, before we get to there, do you guys have anything you want to jump in or add? Do you have any thoughts or questions you want to discuss? And this is where, Charlie, I would say, I think Sam being nervous about Frodo and Gollum, I think there's something to that that I do think might fit this. I really do.
Well, I won't go that way, but okay. I think things that God cares about that we would be right to be jealous over, truth, goodness, beauty,
yep.
The church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why does it matter how we do things in the church?
Mm-hmm.
Because God cares about how things are done in the church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah, just some of the things that I was thinking there.
Think about all the times in the pastoral epistles that God makes the point, like the gathering of the church body, dependent on it being the pillar and the ground of truth. You have to guard the truth. You don't allow other people to speak wrong truths. You, like the person who's like wayward, you warn them a couple times and then you distance yourself. Like, God takes that stuff very seriously.
Yeah.
And for us to love what God loves, there should be a little bit of like a right intensity in those directions. Okay, so final thoughts as we wrap this up. If you think about how God loves with a jealous love, and God's jealousy is like this intense response, there's a long-term commitment to it. How would that kind of jealousy thinking affect our friendships? So I know we would say that we're forgiving, but we really do have a 70x7 limit at certain times. I'm not saying you just continue to take abuse from a friend who's being horribly wicked to you, but do we love other people in our friendships the way God would love us consistently and persistently? Think about it with your parents, or if you are a parent. Some of you have children who have really rebelled, and persistently so. And what are you going to do? Is there a limit at which you're like, you know what? I'm done. You're dead to me. And I'm not saying that that means you take the abuse, you take the harm, you let them keep living with no consequences or responsibilities. I'm not saying that. But we need to really cautiously guard how we love our children and make sure that we don't slip into a performance-style love. And then lastly, if you are married, consider your spouse. Do you love your spouse jealously? I heard once of a guy who was trying to provoke his wife to cheat because he wanted to get a divorce. And I think to myself, there is no amount of biblical love behind that. That's total wickedness. And probably none of us at this table would ever do that. But if you are in a marriage, be really careful that you're being zealous for your spouse. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on the Thinklings podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings podcast.